The Tolkien Road, Episode 237, The Shaping of Middle-Earth. Hello there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 237, The Shaping of Middle-Earth. Greta, what's up?
Hey, what is up? Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. What's up with you?
Not a whole lot. Just waiting for the intro music to end as usual.
Surely we can do better than this.
Well, you know, I just need to shorten it at some point, get my act together.
Wow. Yeah.
Got a lot of things to get my act together on, but let's talk about this episode.
Yeah,
on this episode,
we
are continuing our journey through the History of Middle-Earth series as we survey Volume 4, The Shaping of Middle-Earth.
The Shaping of Middle-Earth.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that is what's the plan for this here episode.
Is there going to be like a lot of geography in this one?
No, not really.
Okay, good.
It's
'cause I was about to piece out if there was.
There is some, but it's not a lot. So okay. It's not the majority of it.
There's like a good balance.
Well, it's not even the majority of it, but you'll see. Jumping the gun. Jumping ahead.
What I do.
Jumping ahead of our patrons, come on.
Oh, that's
man,
not right.
So messed up.
Shame on me.
Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons and a big special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Elise Yu, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you all so much. Thank you to all of our amazing patrons. You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks, like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. Check it out now to learn more about all of the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free.
So, oh, I didn't realize that deal was still going on.
Yeah,
that's
still
good.
Going on. That's the deal.
That's a good
for
one.
You make an annual pledge, you get 1 month free.
Oh,
right?
It's like an Yeah,
now
it was just like a
I did 2 months free, but that was just for that, the early adopters there.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay. Well, still 1 month free. That's not a bad deal.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty, you saving 1 month, getting 11, 12 months for 11 months price. That's what I'm talking about.
That's right. It's like a Costco gift card where you pay like $45 for a $50 gift card.
Okay.
It's pretty much the best deal going. Well, besides becoming a patron of Tolkien Road, obviously. Anyway.
You totally messed that up, man.
No, I didn't. I totally wrapped it up, tied it with a string.
I mean, you compared this work of genius and art to the commodities of Costco.
You know what? You get a gift card to the right restaurant, there's genius and art in that as well.
Moving on.
Cannot argue with that.
You also need right now, right this second, to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leaving us a 5-star rating and a review helps get the word out about the Tolkien Road.
Indeed.
So do that.
Please.
And then check out our YouTube channel. Just visit tolkienroad.com/YouTube. We are, all of our episodes are now in video form. So just instead of just listening to us blab on about Tolkien, you can watch us blab on about Tolkien.
Engaging an additional sense
and,
there.
And really, I must say that in terms of the, just the utter appreciation of an episode of The Tolkien Road, you really need to see the subtleties of our facial expressions to really understand what we're trying to communicate. So
it's true.
You need to do yourself a favor and become a subscriber on our YouTube channel as well so that you can see these episodes and just know all of the amazing facial expressions that you are missing out on. So
indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's
looking at my guitars and seeing what t-shirt I'm wearing. So yeah.
I'm not wearing a cool t-shirt today. My t-shirts are normally cooler than yours though.
Well, I guess it depends on what you think is cool.
Well, you've bought most
if
of
you
them
think
for
lame
me,
stuff's
so.
Cool, then I guess you're right.
Whatever. You've bought me most of those t-shirts, so maybe it's your taste that's lame.
Oh, sorry. Were you saying something? I was taking a drink of water.
I was going to say something else, but I can't remember what it is now. Oh, well.
All right. Well, the point is,
yeah,
subscribe to us on YouTube.
You'll get the full experience if you subscribe to us on YouTube.
Right on.
That's That's what we're trying to say. Then you can actually see me slap John instead of just hear me slap John next time I get the urge.
Mm. And that's it's that is worth the price of admission alone. And you can leave comments super easy on YouTube as well. So, you know, just do it.
Just do it. You have nothing to lose.
All right. And hey, shout out to people who are watching us on YouTube right now. We love you.
Sup, sup.
All right. Stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence. Greta, you ready to dive in?
Yep.
All right.
I am.
So on this episode, we will be providing a brief overview of The Shaping of Middle-Earth, which is the fourth volume in the History of Middle-Earth series. It was published in 1986. You can see here, because you're watching on video, my copy of The Shaping of Middle-Earth, this mass market paperback, which is not what I would recommend to be the normal format that you read Tolkien in, because the print is very small, and especially with these works, it makes it very challenging even to just like do research and keep the book open like this while you're trying to type notes like I was as I prepared for this episode. But that's really beside the point. What's important is the content in here. This was published in 1986. The preface. All right. So let's read a little snippet from the preface. The preface isn't super long, a couple of pages. But here's what Christopher has to say about this volume. This is the stage at which my father had arrived when The Hobbit was written, so roughly 1936, 1937, the mid-30s. Comparison of the Quinta with the published Silmarillion will show that the essential character of the work was now fully in being. In the shape and fall of sentences, even of whole passages, the one is constantly echoed in the other, and yet the published Silmarillion is between 3 and 4 times as long. After the hasty sketch of the mythology, chapter 2 in this book, the Quinta Noldorinwa was in fact the only complete version of the Silmarillion that my father ever made. Towards the end of 1937, he interrupted work on a new version, Quinta Silmarillion, which extended into partway through the story of Turin Turambar and began The Lord of the Rings. When, after many years, he returned to the First Age, the vast extension of the world that had now come into being meant that the Quinta Silmarillion, which had been stopped in full flight, could not be taken up from where it fell. And though he undertook exceedingly complex revisions and enlargements of the earlier parts during the following years, he never achieved again a complete and coherent structure. Especially in its concluding chapters, the Quinta Noldorwina is thus one of the primary elements in the study of the work as a whole. So there's more to it than that. But basically, you know, what to take away from this preface is that this is where this is as far as Tolkien had gotten with the Legendarium by the time The Hobbit was published. And of course, it wasn't too much longer after The Hobbit was published that he began work on Lord of the Rings, right, as the new Hobbit, as the sequel to The Hobbit. So, and really what you're going to see with this work, this is where, you know, the Legendarium starts to kind of take a little bit more of a familiar cohesion in terms of binding it all together, right? You know, when we looked at the Book of Lost Tales, there were a lot of these tales that were bound together by this frame narrative of the Cottage of Lost Play, and all these characters on what island were they on? Anyway, I forgot the name of the island because I'm dumb. But they were on they were bound together in this with this frame narrative, the Cottage of Lost Play, with various characters, various elvish men, characters telling these, you know, telling these lost tales, right? Then with the Lays of Beleriand, we had, you know, these poetic versions of two of the more significant tales of Beleriand with the Lay of Lithien, aka the Tale of Tenubiel, and then the Children of Húrin, right? And some other snippets that we saw in there. But with this, this is where Tolkien... What we find here is that Tolkien is kind of putting that all together and looking back and saying, okay, these are the stories that I wrote and I started to map out. And he's starting to take the time to explain these things to others and realizing that he might need to explain these things to others at some point in the not too distant future. So that's kind of the idea that we have with this. There are 7 chapters in this work. The titles of these chapters are Prose Fragments Following the Lost Tales. Chapter 2 is the earliest Silmarillion, a.k.a. the sketch of the mythology. Chapter 3 is the Quinta. Chapter 4 is the first Silmarillion map. Chapter 5 is the Ambarkanta. Chapter 6 is the earliest annals of Valinor. And Chapter 7 is the earliest annals of Beleriand. So, Chapter 1. Prose Fragments Following the Lost Tales. This is a pretty short chapter. So, it, as you can tell from the chapter, these are simply fragments. These aren't. This isn't any long... particularly long work here. what Christopher says at the beginning. He says, before giving the sketch of the mythology, the earliest form of the prose Silmarillion, there are some brief prose texts that can be conveniently collected here. And so basically there are three of these, right? Each of them consists of a couple of pages in this book. And the three fragments are from Torlin and the Exiles of Gondolin, right? So this would be a, you know, a fragment, a prose fragment from a post-Gondolin, Fall of Gondolin's story. A Tale of the Gnomes, and then The Flight of the Noldoli, right? Okay. So not terribly long, not going to spend a whole lot of time looking closely at these, but that's what you have in the first chapter here. The second chapter is where, you know, it starts to get a little more interesting. The earliest Silmarillion, this is the sketch of the mythology. This is what a little bit from what Christopher has to say at the beginning of this chapter. He says, the sketch represents a new, when he refers to the sketch, he's referring, so this is titled The Earliest Silmarillion or The Sketch of the Mythology, and he refers to it often as the sketch in here. So the sketch represents a new starting point in the history of the Silmarillion. For while it is a quite brief synopsis, the further written development of the prose form proceeded from it in a direct line. It is clear from details that need not be repeated here that it was originally written in 1926, after the Lay of the Children of Húrin had been abandoned, but it was afterwards revised in places very heavily, and this makes it a difficult text to present in a way that is both accurate and readily comprehensible. The method I have adopted is to give the text exactly as it was first written, apart from a very few slight alterations of expression in no way affecting the narrative, which are adopted silently into the text, but to break it up into short sections, following each with notes given the later changes made in that section. I must emphasize that there is no manuscript warrant for the 19 divisions so made. It is purely a matter of convenience of presentation. This method has certain advantages. The later changes can be readily compared with the original text immediately preceding, and since the following version of the Silmarillion, the Quainta, has been treated in the same way and divided into corresponding numbered sections, passages of the one can be easily related to those in the other. The later changes are referenced by numbers that begin with 1 in each section. The commentary follows at the end of the complete text and is related to the numbered sections. So, so basically, to summarize what Christopher just said there, this is kind of a summary of the stories of the Legendarium, right, that Tolkien himself wrote. And then Christopher comes along, takes that, and divides that into 19 a little more easily digestible sections. And as you can see here, Greta, I mean, we're talking, basically, we talk sections, we're talking like a few paragraphs, yeah, right?
They're not very long.
They're not very long at all. And then he provides some notes after each of those sections. So the divisions are Christopher's, but the text itself is J.R.R. Tolkien's. So I'm going to read the first one of these just to give you a little flavor of what we're dealing with here. One thing to note, another thing to note here is that he wrote this with the Children of Húrin in mind, right? So he had written, you know, a lot on the Children of Húrin by this point, and he wrote this in an effort to explain the background mythology for the Children of Húrin to somebody who was going to read the Children of Húrin, right? All right, so this is section one. After the dispatch of the Nine Valar for the governance of the world, Morgoth, Demon of Dark, rebels against the overlordship of Manwë, overthrows the lamp set up to illumine the world, and floods the isle where the Valar, or gods, dwelt. He fortifies a palace of dungeons in the north. The Valar remove to the uttermost west, bordered by the outer seas and the final wall, and eastward by the towering mountains of Valinor, which the gods built. In Valinor, they gather all light and beautiful things and build their mansions, gardens, and city. But Manwë and his wife Brithil have halls upon the highest mountains, Timbrinting, or Tendbrinting in English, Tingvetil in Gnomish, Tanaquetil in Elfin, whence they can see across the world in the dark to the dark east. Ifan Beláirin plants the two trees in the middle of the plain of Valinor outside the gates of the city of Valmar. They grow under her songs, and one has dark green leaves with shining silver beneath, and white blossoms like the cherry from which a dew of silver light falls. The other has golden-edged leaves of young green like the beech and yellow blossom like the hanging blossoms of laburnum, which give out heat and blazing light. Each tree waxes for 7 hours to full glory and then wanes for 7. Twice a day, therefore, comes a time of softer light when each tree is faint and their light is mingled. So, you know, pretty familiar for us there in terms of the mythology. We see a lot, condensed into one paragraph here. One thing that stood out to me, was that the wife of Manwë is Brithil here, Bridhil. So that is much different from Varda, right?
Yes. So, I would agree.
So that was obviously a change that took place at some time further down the line. That's a little flavor. So you're going to get that, that kind of looks summary form, with the rest of it, not very dramatized, but just kind of laying out, the facts of what has happened, of what's preceded, right? So it's kind of like previously on the Children of Húrin, right? And it's like first part, second part. So it would be a pretty long previously, but that's kind of the idea.
That's helpful though. I think
it's very helpful. Yeah. And this is a chapter, honestly, I'd like to, I think it'd be fun to deal with in some depth. I think a lot of the chapters in here are actually like that, because it'd be interesting to look at how you could do a pretty easy comparison between different sections of this with how things were in, are in the published Silmarillion, to see how they developed over time.
Definitely.
So, chapter 3 is titled The Quenta. All right. So, let me get there. It is page 92 in here. Let me read a little of the intro from Christopher. This work is extant in a typescript made by my father, for which there is no trace of any preliminary notes or drafts. That the Quenta, or at any rate the greater part of it, was written in 1930 seems to me to be certainly deducible. After a quite different initial section, which is the origin of the Vala Quenta, this text becomes a reworking and expansion of the sketch of the mythology, and it quickly becomes evident that my father had the sketch in front of him when he wrote the Quenta. The latter moves towards the Silmarillion in its published form, both in structure and in language. Ariel is mentioned both in the title of Quenta and at the end of the work, and is coming to Quartirion, but there is no trace of the Cottage of Lost Play. So the Cottage of Lost Play gets phased out, right? It's no longer a part of the, really much of a part of the legendarium after the earlier writings. As I have said of its absence, this does not demonstrate that my father had rejected the conception in its entirety. In sketch, he may have omitted it because his purpose was solely to recount the history of the Elder Days in condensed form, while in the title of Quenta, it is said that the work was drawn from the Book of Lost Tales, which Ariel of Lythian wrote. At least then, we may think, some venue in which the Lost Tales were told to Ariel and Quartirion still existed. So it's not necessarily that Tolkien completely rejected it, but it doesn't play as... You can see how Tolkien, in trying to explain these things, is not necessarily relying too heavily on the frame narrative anymore. And as he doesn't have to rely on that anymore, it maybe becomes less convenient to explain it to people using the frame narrative, right? The frame narrative in his mind might become a little bit, seem confusing to others. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The title makes it very plain that while the Quenta was written in a finished manner, my father saw it as a compendium, a brief history that was drawn from a much larger work, and this aspect remained an important element in his conception of the Silmarillion, properly so called. I do not know whether this idea did indeed arise from the fact that the starting point of the second phase of the mythological narrative was a condensed synopsis, but it seems likely enough from the step-by-step continuity that leads through from sketch through Quenta to the version that was interrupted towards its end in 1937. Long story short, this is a little bit of an expanded version of the sketch here that we looked at with the last chapter. So it's, it's developing, but we can see how a lot of the stories in Tolkien's mind were much longer stories. We see that, like, things like the Children of Húrin, the Tale of Tenuviel, these had the potential to be like novel length stories, right, in his mind, but he also felt the need to connect all, he was feeling increasingly the need to connect all these things together into one work that kind of saw them as a complete history of the early ages of Middle-earth, right, the early mm-hmm. legendarium of Middle-earth. So that's mm-hmm. the work he was doing, in this period, and that Christopher focuses on in this book. This is also 19 brief passages. So I'm just going to read a little bit of actually what I've highlighted here, but you can see here that he's added on. So what I read in the, from the last chapter was from the very beginning of that. He's added on more about what takes place. What we're familiar with is like the Valaquenta, what takes place before, what takes place before that, like kind of opening history when they're already in, when the Valar are already in Middle Earth, right? So he's trying to explain a little bit more of what took place before that. After the making of the world, but you know what? I'm going to read the title here too. The Quenta herein, the Quenta herein is Quenta Noldorwina or Penas na Negolaith. This is the brief history of the Noldoli or gnomes drawn from the Book of Lost Tales, which Ariel of Lythien wrote, having read the Golden Book, which the Eldar called Parma Kuluina in Quartirion and Tol Eressëa, the Lonely Isle. After the making of the world by the All-Father, who in Elvish tongue is named Iluvatar, many of the mightiest spirits that dwelt with him came into the world to govern it, because seeing it after it was made, they were filled with delight at its beauty. These spirits the elves named the Valar, which is the powers, though men have often called them gods. Many spirits they brought in their train, both great and small, and some of these men have confused with the Eldar or elves. But wrongly, for they were before the world, but elves and men awoke first in the world after the coming of the Valar. Yet in the making of elves and men, excuse me, and in the giving to each of their especial gifts, Iluvatar alone had part. Wherefore they are called the children of the world or of Iluvatar. So, and he goes on, the chieftains of the Valar were nine, and goes on to explain more about them there. And then it really proceeds in giving, you know, that history, you know, that kind of history mm-hmm. of the rest of the early ages of Middle Earth, early periods of Middle Earth. So, yeah, you know, bringing it all together, synthesizing all of these things into one cohesive, you know, overall cohesive narrative seems to be that big goal with these writings. Chapter 4 is the first Silmarillion map. So for those of you who are map people, this is fun. He includes facsimiles of these things here and here, so you can kind of check out what Tolkien was working on, just to give a little bit of what Christopher had to say about this. This map was made on a sheet of examination paper from the University of Leeds, as opposed to an exercise book, Greta. So, which suggests that it originated in association with the lay, or perhaps rather with the sketch of the mythology which was written to accompany it. On the other hand, some names which seem to belong with the first making of the map do not appear in the texts before the Quenta. Though it was not drawn initially in a way that would suggest that my father intended it to endure, it was his working map for several years, and it was much handled and much altered. Names were embedded in places recited. The writing is in red ink, black ink, green ink, pencil, and blue crayon, often overlaying each other. Lines representing contours and others representing streams tangle with lines for redirection and lines canceling other lines. But it is striking that the river courses as drawn on this first map were scarcely changed at all afterwards. And there's more to be said of it. But basically, in this chapter, Christopher refers to the map that he includes and then talks about the different places named on it. So that's chapter 4 for you. Chapter 5, the Ambarkanta. This is titled Of the Fashion of the World. It's basically a cosmology. And this is actually attributed to Rumil, who is another character from the Cottage of Lost Play. So we can see there's still these vestiges of that frame narrative that are hanging on that, you know, are still important in Tolkien's mind, which again does make it an interesting question of whether it should have been published with a frame narrative around it in the first place, right? When Christopher eventually published it in 1977.
Where would that frame narrative have come from, though? Like, I mean, I know it was part of the Book of Lost Tales, but where... You're talking about having published the Silmarillion, mm-hmm. right, with a frame narrative. So are you saying that he should have used the frame narrative that's presented in the Book of Lost Tales? And then use that in the Silmarillion, or
well, I'm not saying he should have necessarily. I'm just saying that it would be interesting how that would have changed. Who that would have changed? I mean, we've talked about this, right?
We have. So, yeah, I was just wondering if that was the particular frame narrative that you were referring to, was the Cottage of Lost Play one.
That one, or I mean, I like the idea of doing one, obviously that has some more familiar, like relatable characters, the problem of no hobbits in the Silmarillion. Where what if you just had the hobbits telling these stories, right?
Gotcha.
Based on things they had heard later on.
That's right, yeah.
So, or speaking with hobbits and other characters we were already familiar with. I think mm-hmm. that would have been really interesting.
And that's maybe something Christopher could have written, or he could have hired someone to write.
Well, yeah, I mean, could have.
I know we're talking very speculatively here. I feel like I hadn't said a whole lot, so I just wanted to interject a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm not trying to keep you from interjecting.
Oh, I know you're not. Yeah.
But, you know, it's just the nature of doing a survey of this kind of work. Sure. So,
yeah.
So
I just didn't want the patrons to miss me.
Oh, well,
of our listeners,
you know what, if you come on and watch us on YouTube, then you can, you know,
you'll know I'm here, even though I'm not speaking.
You can see all of the contributions of her curious expressions and confusion as I walk through some of this stuff. So.
Confusion is probably the predominant expression on my face right now.
Right.
Anyways. Yeah. Well, back to the subject at hand.
I don't think I'm too much less confused than you are. It's a lot, right? And I haven't read every detail of these works. I've, you know, just kind of been skimming each of the chapters, trying to get a feel for what's located in each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot to be said.
Yeah.
Speaking of maps, just real quick. I mean, there's this facsimile of the first Silmarillion map. And then there's some different diagrams that are interesting too. So this is a kind of a fun, if you are that map, if you like that visual kind of representation of this world, you wonder what Tolkien's own early conceptions of it looked like. There are, you know, three diagrams in addition to the earliest Silmarillion map. There are three diagrams and then two other maps, right? And they're pretty interesting, right? So one of the maps gives a full view of the entire world of Arda, right? As Tolkien envisioned it, and gives some notes on that. One of them gives a representation of what the world would have looked like, I believe. So this would have been after, I believe this would have been after Morgoth threw down the lamps. But yeah, and then there's three diagrams in here as well that are worth checking out that seem to be applicable to Amarkanta, so which is chapter 5. So Amarkanta is chapter 5. We talked about Rumil. And it's the title of it, the subtitle of it is Of the Fashion of the World. So a little snippet from this. About all the world are the Ilurambar, or walls of the world. They are as ice and glass and steel, being above all imagination of the children of earth, cold, transparent, and hard. They cannot be seen, nor can they be passed, save by the door of night. Within these walls the earth is globed. Above, below, and upon all sides is Vaya, the enfolding ocean. But this is more like to sea below the earth, and more like to air above the earth. In Vaya, below the earth, dwells Olmo. Above the earth lies the air, which is called Vista, and sustains birds and clouds. Therefore it is called above Fanyamar, or Cloud Home, and below Iwenore, or Birdland. But this air lies only upon Middle Earth and the inner seas, and its proper bounds are the mountains of Valinor in the west and the walls of the sun in the east. Therefore clouds come seldom in Valinor, and the mortal birds pass not beyond the peaks of its mountains. But in the north and south, where there is most cold and darkness, and Middle Earth extends nigh to the walls of the world, Vaya and Vista and Ilmen flow together and are confounded. So, you know, this is kind of a cosmology. You know, it's giving an idea of like kind of how early peoples might have understood this world and the names for the different kind of elements of the world in an ancient fashion. So, you know, in a way it's like elvish science, right? You know, like how would they have understood this world that they were in? So
where's the title come from? Did I miss that?
I think it means the shape of the world or the fashion of the world, right? So
in elvish.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if it's translated.
It's just a cool word that I've never heard before. So I was wondering.
It is a cool word. I agree.
Where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It'd be cool to name something. I don't know what you name Amarkanta, but.
Well, I think you could name a pet Amarkanta, but mm-hmm. you would have to shorten it somehow.
Bark.
There you go.
Name
perfect.
Name a dog.
Amarkanta. Just call him Bark.
Barkley.
It's perfect. Now I have to get a dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or
gotta
we
get
could be highly ironic and just name a cat Amarkanta and call it Bark.
Mm-hmm. Right mm-hmm. on.
Yeah. Or a bird.
Man, you're really giving it the old college try on making the contributions for this episode.
I'm really trying. I feel like I've spent more time drinking water than talking on this episode. So,
yeah, I kind of had a feeling this one would be like that because it is, you know, it's not that there's not a lot to discuss, but given that I have not really put any reading assignments on you for this series,
I do appreciate, by the way,
because. I mean, I'm coming, like, it's a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And just prepping for it and figuring out what to highlight for our listeners is enough work mm-hmm. for me. And I kind of want you to come into it fresh and just chime in with whatever you think.
That's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I appreciate it because I think if you had given me reading assignments, my brain cells would have exploded.
It is hard mental work. It is hard. This, like, going through this series is hard mental work, no doubt. My brain, as I prepare my notes for these episodes, typically, and just trying to do a survey, my brain at the end of preparing the notes for each episode is kind of just hurts.
A little mushy. So,
yeah, for reals. So mental exercise. There you go.
It's good for you.
I take the pain for you guys. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I get my mental exercise by playing Wordscapes.
Patreon.com/Tolkien Road.
Wordscapes is cool.
Yeah, too. Wordscapes is cool. That's what Greta says. This episode brought to you by Wordscapes.
I'm just saying, you're not the only one that's getting a mental exercise.
You know what I play? Mm-hmm. I play Gardenscapes, I think.
Yeah, are they related?
I don't know. They must be
somehow.
All them scapes.
Well, I think
Wordscapes. It's called Gardenscapes.
It is called Gardenscapes. I've seen you play it before.
Yeah.
Mine's, the one I do is Wordscapes.
It's basically puzzles of fruit and stuff.
Yeah, see, I don't like puzzles. Puzzles make my brain hurt.
But what's cool about it is you get to, it's got a frame narrative. You basically get to create this awesome garden, like, around, as you finish a puzzle, you get to do, like, tasks to build up this garden. I'll have to show you my garden sometime.
I'd love to see your garden.
Man, I feel like a complete nerd admitting this to you guys. No, this, like, I just like the puzzles, so this is like, in making the cool gardens is just kind of the icing on the cake. So now you guys know what I do with all my free time.
Too bad we can't make it a real garden. That would be more fun for me.
Yeah,
because then I could arrange flowers in a vase. Anyway,
well, you're the garden person.
I know,
but I'm doing, you know, I've been out here getting some things cleaned up. Allergies have just been bad. The pollen's been bad. All right, rabbit trail. Man, this has been you got us on that rabbit trail. It's your fault.
Well, you're the one started talking about mental exercise.
Here comes the bad ratings. Oh, all these people ever do, they don't even talk about Tolkien. They just talk about Gardenscapes and video games and naming dogs.
Well, they're not talking about Wordscapes and Gardenscapes. They're reading from a book. I don't get to hear Greta talk.
All right, well, let's finish this thing up.
All right, let's do it.
Chapter 6 is the earliest annals of Valinor. So here's a little bit of what Christopher has to say. I refer to this work as the earliest annals of Valinor because it was followed later in the 1930s by a second version, and then, after the completion of The Lord of the Rings, and very probably in 1951-52, by a third entitled The Annals of Aman, which, though still a part of the continuous evolution of these annals, is a major new work, and which contains some of the finest prose in all the matter of the Elder Days. These earliest annals of Valinor are comprised in a short manuscript of 9 pages written in ink. This is a good deal of emendation and interpolation, some changes being made in ink and probably not much, if any, later than the first writing of the text, while a second layer of change consists of alterations in faint and rapid pencil that are not always legible. These latter include 2 quite substantial passages, given in note 14 and 18, which introduce wholly new material concerning events in Middle-earth. So, kind of like what we had with the sketch and then the Quinta and chapters 2 and chapter 3, this is kind of a summary, but this is even, in my mind, even more enjoyable because it's written as in a similar way to what we get with Appendix B in Lord of the Rings, right? Where it's that, like, chronology, it's a tale mm-hmm. of the years, right? Mm-hmm. So we're actually given mm-hmm. years to attribute to all these things. That's really cool in the case of the Silmarillion, because in the Silmarillion itself, we don't really have a timetable, right? We don't really know, like, how much time elapses, especially early on. So with this chapter, The Earliest Annals of Valinor, we have something of Tolkien's mind about how much time was actually elapsing in the, you know, in the period really before the First Age, right? From the creation of the world and the Valar entering the world all the way to the darkening of Valinor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it starts out with kind of the synopsis of how things began with the Iluvatar and creating the Valar. And then this is really interesting. A little bit later, it says, time was counted in the world before the sun and moon by the Valar according to ages. And a Valian age hath 100 of the years of Valar, which are each as 10 years are now. So from that, it makes it sound like a Valar year is 10 of our years, right? 10 normal years. Okay, so it would be a decade. And then an age, a Valian age, is 100 decades, right? So 1,000 years, so basically a millennium. Now, that's what but you can get tripped up when you read the timetable because it uses years like 500, you know, Valian year 500, Valian year 1,000. But if that's Valian year 500, that's actually human year 5,000. Valian year 1,000 would be human year 10,000. And this thing extends through almost 3,000 Valian years, right? Which means how many total human years? 30,000, right? So the time from the creation of Arda until the darkening of Valinor, right? Roughly the darkening of Valinor, we're talking 30,000 years, right?
It's a lot.
A long time,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So, you know, if I don't know of anywhere else, we may see this in later works of the history of Middle Earth, but I don't know anywhere else where Tolkien contradicts that. So when we look at the Silmarillion, the indication we have is that his mind was to think that this was roughly a 30,000 year period, you know, leading up to the darkening of Valinor was a roughly 30,000 year period, right?
Okay.
So in our own human years. And that's borne out in this chapter. So this one's particularly interesting for those of you like me who like, you know, timetables and like understanding how much time has elapsed in these various stories. You're going to get a good sense of what Tolkien had in mind with that.
Especially if you're good at math.
Well, and you don't really even have to be good at math. He kind of lays it out. Let me see if did I mark this here? He gives that. There's a table in here, actually, and I don't think I marked the actual page of it. But, oh, yeah, here we go. So he actually gives a table in Valian years and then says, and then what sun years would be. So he called in man years, he calls them sun years, right?
Okay.
And so 2993 being the doom of Mondos in Valian years, and then in the years of the sun, it would be 29,992, right?
Hmm.
Let's see, the landing of the Feanorians and the encampment in Mithrim, right? Which would be their, you know, when they come to Beleriand, right? 2995 in Valian years, 29,995 in Sun years.
Why the difference?
That's just how they reckoned it. I mean, that, you know, Valar are gods, so for them, what...
They're basically outside of time,
well,
right?
They're not outside of time, but they live for... They're immortal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, and in their mind too, they might have been in the halls of Iluvatar before they actually entered the world for millions of our years, for all we know, right?
Yeah.
We have no idea how long that period was. I mean, let me just check here. So, you know, how long was the beginning year, you know, before year zero that's listed in this table? We don't really, you know, have a sense of that. But, you know, they're immortal beings, so as opposed to our mortality, so they reckon, you know, they live for much longer.
Mm-hmm.
Their existence has existed for much longer than ours has, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they account these things much longer, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's an arbitrariness to all the, you know, scales of time and that kind of thing, of course, but that's the scale they used. And
it's kind of like how we reckon like human years and dog years.
Yeah.
Is
but of course,
similar,
but of course our human year. So the arbitrariness goes away in this, and that our human year is how long it takes for the Earth to orbit the sun. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where our kind of concept of the year came from, in human terms, right? But for the Valar, for those first 30,000 years, there was no sun, right?
Oh,
there was no sun.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, where did that time come from? And maybe I'm missing something in the note in this chapter. There may be some explanation as to why they had that certain period of time fixed as a Valian year and then a Valian age. But I, you know, I didn't find that in the text in my surveying it. So.
Cool.
Yeah. A good question.
Thanks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the last chapter, chapter 7, is the earliest annals of Beleriand. So this this would come after the Noldor come to Beleriand, and this is the period where that roughly corresponds to like chapter 10 on in the Silmarillion. What's really interesting is that if the first 10 chapters were roughly a 30,000 year period, this, according to the annals of Beleriand, is a roughly 250 year period, so much shorter, right? So that first age, what we're accustomed to thinking of as the first age of Middle Earth, is 250 years, as opposed to 3,000 years for the second and third ages. So anyway, I find that interesting that all those stories took place in a relatively short period of time, right? In that 250 year period. So at least according to the earliest annals of Beleriand. I think that timetable may have been expanded a little later. I don't have the reference in front of me, but I feel like there was an indication that it was longer at a different time. But yeah, so the earliest annals of Beleriand are basically the same kind of thing laid out in these years according to what events took place in those years. So something like Appendix B of The Lord of the Rings. So read a little snippet from this. All right, so we'll say year 20. Feast and games of reuniting were held at Nan Tathrin, the land of willows near the delta of Sirion, between the elves of Valinor returning and the dark elves, both those of the western havens, Brithombar and Eldorest, and the scattered wood elves of the west and ambassadors of Thingol. A time of peace followed. So, there you go.
Okay.
Right on.
I like peace.
Yes. So, that, listeners, is the Shaping of Middle-earth. So, little summary for you. Got it, Greta?
As much as I'm ever going to get it, yes.
Well, that might not be as much as you ever get it, but, you know.
For the time being,
hopefully
it's
a good introduction for you.
Oh, no, it is. It's a very thorough introduction. Thank you for that.
Yeah, on episode 238, we'll survey volume 5, The Lost Road and Other Writings. All right. So, all right. Well, so I think we're going to, based on time, we're kind of working on a short schedule this week. So I think we're going to save our correspondence that we're planning on for next time. We'd love to hear from you as always. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And on our, we will be getting back to you with episode 238 on volume 5, The Lost Road and Other Writings, next time. So
sounds good.
All right. Thanks to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lee Sue,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Sam N,
Mike M,
Durenayir,
Robert H,
Paul D,
and Jacob S.
Thanks, guys.
As well as Jonathan D., who celebrates his patron anniversary this month.
Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks to all of you, and thanks to our listeners as well, and we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.